What is up? See, Escambini and my buddy Bibby. What's up, Bibbs? If you guys want to come up, feel free to raise your hands. I was just about to leave. I think there might have been a small miscommunication on this episode. It was scheduled for 11 Eastern like normal, but one of our promos said 8 a.m., which normally that would be Pacific time for Sandy. And it's at 8 a.m. Eastern time. So sorry about that for those who may be listening to this and see the confusion. But Sandy is in New York City this week for NFT NYC. I was going to host the space and still talk about staking. I see two people, but maybe if people start to roll in, we can go that route. If you guys want to raise your hand and come up, feel free. We can discuss anything you like, whether it's NFTs, staking, crypto, your thoughts on NFT NYC this week. Have you seen anything or heard anything? Maybe some people will roll in and we can roll into the actual class. Or it may just be that it could be a dead space due to NFT NYC the weekend and our timing as far as miscommunication, as far as the time slot. So Bibby has his hand raised. Go ahead and call you up, Bibster. Hey, Bibby, can you hear me?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Does my sound okay?
Yeah, sounds good.
Awesome. How are you?
Not too bad. Just got up, flipped on the X, and I was like, oh, goody, I've got a space here. Let's see what's going on.
Yeah, Sandy was going to be out this week, so I was hosting a space here for us on the Chronicles Episode 6. And I was going to talk about what is staking, because that term is so thrown around quite a bit, and it doesn't always mean the same thing depending on who and what you're talking about. So
right,
that would be a good topic to especially a lot of these NFT people, they come into crypto to shield their art, sell their art, and build communities. They have a lot of things that they do well and a lot of things they understand, but when it comes to the blockchain, a lot of them are not necessarily the most well-versed in like everything crypto, everything DeFi, everything blockchain. And even you, Bibby, like you know what it was like to be new. So you come in, you're trying to learn all these things, and it's like moving 100 miles per hour. And it's constantly changing. So someone says the word staking, even if you think you know what they mean, you may not.
Right. Yeah, no, it's a good idea for sure. A lot of these people might just want to play along instead of getting any attention drawn to them, right? Just pretend like they know what they're talking about. So I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who would appreciate it.
Yeah, for sure. And also I see we have Escambini or Escabin in the audience. Feel free if you want to raise your hand and come up, Escabin. You can. If you have questions, feel free. For those who don't know me, I've been in crypto for since 2012, so about it's like 10, 11, 12. So that's like 12 years. Started buying Bitcoin early on. And of course, back then you had a much more limited array of altcoins, but just altcoin trading early. Went through the first ICO boom and both of the first early halving cycles. Good to see all that. And I was instantly hooked. So I was one of those people that I witnessed the idea of proof of stake from the very beginning. And, you know, back in the early days, when you did proof of stake, you actually were depositing that stake token, and you were trusting that you were going to get those tokens back and get your reward. So it's changed quite a bit over the years with the creation of smart contracts and the different standards. Of course, you have staking like we see in Cosmos, where you have a lockup time, where you have to unlock your stake. and it takes a certain amount of time for it to become liquid again so that you can use it. You have liquid staking, like what we see over on Tezos and Cardano, where just by holding the token on your address and you select a validator, you're staking, which is a little bit different. A lot of people I know sell NFTs on Tezos, and they're just holding their Tezos or XTZ tokens when they sell something, and they're not earning that interest rate. If it's just sitting there and you have not delegated those tokens to a validator on the network, you're not earning the interest rate. However, on Tezos, it's as simple as going through and delegating to a specific validator like you would on Cosmos or Ethereum, where you lock it up. The difference is they're liquid. So should you need to move those, and as soon as you move them, your stake is, your bonding is broken. But it's kind of cool because you can come and go. And then, of course, you know, on the locked versions of proof of stake, you see that we have liquid staking there as well. The difference is you're kind of giving custody of your stake tokens rather than controlling it yourself. You're giving it to someone or a protocol or a smart contract, and you may or may not have a wide variety or choices over who the validator is. It becomes a little bit more centralized to an extent, although some of them do try to spread out the validators. But yeah, that's where you can kind of get the best of both worlds. You have the locked tokens to help secure the network, but then you get the derivative. They call it the liquid staking derivative, LSD for short. And basically, those are like an IOU. So it's like a receipt. You're depositing your tokens in to be staked to the network, but at the same time, you get an IOU token that's liquid that you can use, and you can use it in DeFi, or you can trade it, or you can hold it. You can LP it with things in DeFi. You can lend it out. So it kind of gives you the ability to earn those staking reward, APR, APY, and still use it because it's liquid as well, which is totally different. If you're holding it on something like LPOS over on Tezos or Cardano, basically, once you remove it from your address, there is nothing you can use it for to still earn the interest rate, plus use it in DeFi. So all of them bring different challenges. We also have delegated proof of stake. And for some of you guys, you may have never ventured over into like delegated proof of stake. Examples of that are like EOS. We see blockchains that were like Hive and Steemit were DPoS, delegated proof of stake. And you know, when you stake your tokens, usually there's some sort of governance mechanism for it if you're staking to the network, right? Meaning you stake your tokens and you can vote, and it's a weighted vote based on the amount of tokens that you're staking. So the validators, they have a lot of tokens, so they have a heavy voting weight. And then different types of proof of stake, like delegated proof of stake, you're actually delegating your voting power to the validator, meaning you're kind of like saying, it's kind of like elected officials in Congress or the Senate or House of Representatives, where you're saying, you know what, I don't have time for all this stuff. If I want to influence how someone votes, I can either fund them with my money by giving them more of my stake, or I can pull that money away from them. So if they're a bad actor, or they do something that's bad for the ecosystem, or they make decisions that you don't agree with that are in line with what you're trying to accomplish in the space, it's more kind of like the traditional governance system that we have now, where you have elected officials. So that's delegated proof of stake. So you can see, just from the networking perspective, staking your tokens to the network, you have different flavors and different types of staking just in that alone. So before we move into any other types of quote unquote staking, as you hear it in the space, I'm going to pause. And does anyone have any questions? I want to welcome Ekib into the stage. And I see Jay Smiles also showed up as well. Thank you guys for coming in. But yeah, Bibby, do you have any questions about staking to the network?
No. I'm just listening. I'm actually, you're teaching me some stuff that I've not heard before. So I'm just going to keep my mouth shut and my ears open.
Awesome. If I can ask.
Yeah, go ahead,
Ekib. I would ask you, in your opinion, looking at foundation of a blockchain, what would be necessary to means that the blockchain is reliable?
Do you mean just in general?
Yeah, because I see, like, what would be the things that would make the blockchain do not work? Like, my concern is how to make stable for a long time, because every day we see new development, updates, and then I feel like anytime something of that just cannot work, and then what would make the blockchain keep working? I'm concerned, for example, when I see blockchains, they most rely on USDC and Tether, and how much can we rely on that?
The easy answer there is you can't. I don't think blockchains are reliant on USDC and Tether. I definitely understand what you mean and what you're saying, and I also understand why you feel that way. But I think when you put it like that, you're thinking about, hey, if I'm a normal everyday person and I'm trying to get into crypto and into blockchain, what am I doing? I'm taking some of my currency, and that might be dollars, that might be pesos, depending on where you're at in the world. But a lot of times, you're right, stable coins, the USDC is the most liquid because it's the most liquid, you know, fiat currency in the world. And I think what you mean is the price, you're not talking about the stability of the blockchain itself, you're talking about like the price stability because it's pegged to dollars. I think the way you have to wrap your brain around it and kind of change your line of thinking is some of them have different use cases. So I think gauging them in terms of dollars is still useful. But when it comes to something like Bitcoin, and we use Bitcoin in particular because Bitcoin is the only one that's really doing a good job of trying to be money. Like, it's not trying to be, you know, cloud storage. It's not trying to be smart contracts. Sure, Bitcoin's going to have some of that stuff built on top of it. But here we are 12 years later, and Bitcoin has been very slow to adopt anything else because its primary reason for existing is to be a form of money and not necessarily trying to be your like your ETH, like your smart contract layer ones and all that kind of stuff. So I think anytime you look at assets and you're trying to evaluate their value, you have to look at adoption, right? If crypto becomes so adopted and so widespread, which I think not instantly, but I think over the next decade or two, or maybe the next 100 years, If a certain portion of these cryptos become so widely adopted, eventually you would start to price goods and services in those cryptos. So let's just use Bitcoin for example, because it does have the first mover advantage and it's been here the longest. Could you price goods and services in other things? Yes, but why would you? So anytime a money becomes adopted and it becomes more liquid and becomes more useful, and people start to price goods and services for it, that becomes a unit of account. I mean, you can price anything in crypto, but that doesn't mean that people are going to use it for that purpose. And you're right. Why would you price something when the price fluctuates? That's why we need stable coins. That's why we still rely on dollars and USD. I think when you're talking about the valuations, the price of certain cryptos, you're right. There's a stability issue there because these assets still suffer from the boom bust cycles, but all assets do. Even gold, even Bitcoin, even dollars. When you look at dollars and different currencies on the market on a world scale, they seem pretty stable, but they're not really that stable at all. Case in point, I lived in Mexico in 2018. Back then, you could get about 20 to 22 pesos per US dollar. Here it is years later, and because of the massive amount of inflation that we've suffered in the U.S. dollar and money printing during the COVID era, you can only now get about 15 or 16 pesos, Mexican pesos per dollar today. So even in that sense, nothing is 100% pure stable. There's no such thing as a static asset where one equals one. So I don't worry about the stability of crypto priced in dollars because I don't truly care about dollars. When I cash out, will I put something in dollars because it's technically the most stable thing I can probably buy and the most liquid thing I can buy to store that value? When the price of a crypto tops out at $100 and I want to sell it and buy back in a bear market for $10 or $20, of course, you got to move it to something. But I think more and more, as you see Bitcoin become more adopted, what I hope is that people start to look at these assets as a store of value because they believe that long term Bitcoin's not going to go anywhere. Ethereum's not going to go anywhere. Now, some of these cryptos are so new that you can't really treat them as a store of value. Even Ethereum is probably, in my book, just now getting to the point where maybe in a bear market, I would store some of my value in ETH. Why? Because it doesn't have the same properties as Bitcoin as far as the ledger being immutable. I mean, they're two different use cases. I'm never going to be a Bitcoin maxi. But when you're talking about like storing value when you sell a crypto back to something, usually for me, it's going to be dollars, gold and silver, or Bitcoin. I'm just now getting to where maybe I'll keep some in ETH, but there's still some things with ETH to me. And when you're talking about even like my favorite, I'm a huge Cosmos junkie. But even for me, like, it doesn't matter what your proof of stake percentage APY APR is. Rarely are you going to keep like your favorite layer one, like Archway, for example, pays 20% roughly APR. I would be better off to sell all my Archway at the top of this bull market and rebuy back in 2027, 2028 at the bottom of the bear. You'll probably end up getting more Arch tokens or any of your favorite L1s or any of your favorite crypto tokens. You're probably better off to sell the top and buy back in, because no amount of staking rewards usually offsets what you could get if you sold the top and bought back in. So that's kind of like my thoughts on it. I definitely understand what you're saying. I hope that kind of helps give you my perspective on it. For me, no assets are ever 100% stable. All assets are going to succumb to some sort of market cycle. There's always going to be a boom bust cycle. I think volatility is actually your friend. I get that it can be very stressful to buy something and people worry about the price you buy something. But remember, not all of these cryptos are meant to be a store of value. And even if long term they can get enough adoption that they can act as a store of value, most of them are so young, they're not there yet. Maybe Bitcoin, and we're starting to see a little bit with ETH, although ETH has its own properties that kind of make it different. So I'm going to shut up for a minute. Does that help, Esteban? And what else did you, what else other thoughts do you have on that?
Thank you, sir. And appreciated your thoughts. And what would be for you a piece of infrastructure that's being built that you put in attention that you feel that's still missing to be developed?
For me, and you're probably going to hear this, like in crypto, anytime a bull market comes around, because you know the way this works typically, and people will say, well, my token's different than Bitcoin, mine's this and mine's that. Yes, eventually you want cryptocurrencies to depeg from being reliant on the native asset of Bitcoin. Kind of like what you said, Escobin, when you said, I'm kind of worried because in dollar valuation prices, the dollar value, it's so unstable. I can't trust to leave my money here, right? Because if I buy $100 worth of something and it drops to 20 and I got to pay a bill, like I'm screwed until the asset price goes back up. And what if it never goes back up? So I think when you're looking at bull markets and you had the Bitcoin halving, usually when Bitcoin finally hits that run, so the halving is coming up this month, right? We've already seen a new all-time high. The all-time high that we just had break in the 70,000s, having a new ATH right before the halving, this is a first. Because back in 2012, when you had the halving, you didn't have a previous halving to go by, so you couldn't necessarily say that. But you could look at 2016. The 2016 halving, you didn't see a new all-time high until about 6 months after the previous halving. And it may have even been later. And then you look at 2020, the same thing, that the halving happened. It was like December before it reached $20,000 again. So usually the post-halving bull run, in my view, people will say we're in a bull market now because if you go from the bottom and you work your way up, that you're in bullish territory. While that's true, going from the bottom, you're in bullish territory. In my book, you're not truly in a bull market until you break the new all-time high. So usually for me, when I'm looking at, are we in a bull market or not, I look at, hey, when do you break the previous all-time high? And that's usually 6 to 8 months after the halving. So I would have expected this year to be in a bull market probably by October or November of this year if the previous trend had continued. However, this time is different. Why? We saw a little bit of a pump going into the halving. We saw it break to 70,000. That's a first. And one thing I always say in crypto is, is you follow the trends, and everything is a trend until it's not. So guess what? This time, we had a new all-time high at 70K. And does that mean that this bull market has already started and it's not going to last as long? Well, we don't know. My guess is you still have to get back to the November, December timeframe. When we start to see the supply crunch post-halving, meaning when you cut the Bitcoin, the new issuance of Bitcoin in half, usually it takes about 6 to 8 months of lag before the miners are forced to start upping the prices of what they're willing to sell. That's always been the case in Bitcoin. So what happens is as that supply crunch happens in Bitcoin and those massive price increases, people are oohing on over 70,000. I thought 67,000 as a high in 2020 was garbage when you consider what we had in 2012 and 2016. To me, because of COVID and the way the world was, it was kind of a lackluster bull market. But if you're brand new, you probably thought it was exciting, just as exciting as I was back in 2012 or 2016, right? And that's normal. That hype cycle and that greed factor, all these things are built into markets, that speculatory part of it that gets you excited. And that's truly what helps adoption. People come for the greed, but they stay once they realize like what crypto is and why it's valuable and how it can help change their life. But as those profits start to overflow, they're going to go into other assets. And Escobin, you mentioned what is something that we need to see built? What is some utility or some sort of infrastructure and things that are built? I think what you just said, I know this was a long-winded answer, but I wanted to get there. One of the biggest narratives, because usually when you see this hype cycle and you see these bull markets, usually every hype cycle has some sort of narrative. One of the biggest narratives, I think, in 2024, and we're already seeing it, is this thing called DePIN, which stands for Decentralized Physical Infrastructure. Why is that important? Well, when you look at the previous cycles, especially like in 2012, 2013 bull run, you didn't have much. Everything was new. In 2016, 2017, you had the ICO boom from Ethereum. All the ICOs came, right? That introduced a new way to invest. Everyone had a token to sell. Everyone had a dream to sell you. And everyone was flipping ICOs for massive amounts of profit. In 2020, you had a lot of wild stuff. The NFT boom had started. The DeFi had matured. All these things are narratives, right? These things are narratives on why you should look at certain sectors or certain niches, different things that are popular like staking and governance and DAOs. These things come and go, right? And as they first get introduced, they're a narrative and they're a hype cycle. And then eventually they become normalized and become adopted. Like if you said DAO back in 2014, people didn't know anything you were talking about. By the time you said DAO in 2017 in the ICO era, people kind of understood it. But if you're brand new to crypto, you still didn't have a clue. 2020, DAOs were just seeing like massive amounts of growth. But then we started to see some of the failures, the cracks in what makes a DAO work, what makes it not work, how can it be abused, how can people lose their money, what things make it great, what's the trade-offs, right? The positives and the negatives of DAOs. Well, this crypto cycle, DePIN is one of the biggest ones. So when you think about DePIN, it's a two-pronged thing. One, it stands for Decentralized Physical Infrastructure. That's going to be things like cloud computing, artificial intelligence and AI, gaming, things like cloud storage, kind of like what we see with Jackal. Those things have actual physical infrastructure. Most of them run like businesses and they have some sort of business model. So when you buy their tokens, you're not just speculating on a price. You're not just speculating on something digital or something that is totally crypto related because, you know, decentralized storage, cloud storage is a big market in the traditional financial world, in the traditional tech world. Like you see cloud computing and cloud storage and AI. They all have narratives outside of crypto, but now that they're in crypto, many of these things are being built out. I think that one of the things that I wanted to see to kind of answer your question is I wanted to see more of those type of things, because the thing that disappointed me in 2020, 2021's bull run was you finally had a mass amount of adoption. You had a lot of eyeballs on it. Yeah, the prices to me were a little bit lackluster. I thought Bitcoin should have broke 100K and it didn't. But the one thing I noticed was the amount of garbage, the amount of meme coins, the amount of scams, the amount of things where you're just like, okay, this is fun, this is cool, but someone's going to get left holding the bag. You're not really investing in anything, or you're investing in something where even if they're not scammers, even if it's not a pyramid or a Ponzi, even if they're honest, these people might be smart enough to develop something and build an app or build a coin or host a blockchain. But most of them didn't have any like long-term vision or long-term business sense. And you can tell that. Why? Because look at how they didn't take profits on their own coins, or they didn't have any kind of structure set up to last through the bear market. How many of these coins disappeared? How many of these development teams abandoned their babies? They build all this stuff up, they do their money grab, and then they disappear or they fizzle out. And some of them are honest people who just, they don't know what they're doing. I think when you look at things like this, Escobin, is you're going to see like actual companies with actual revenue models. And now you're not just investing in some random crypto token with some promise. You're investing with someone who has hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars of investment in actual, like, you know, hardware and infrastructure. So when I buy the Jackal token, like, I'm buying, I don't want to say a stock, but obviously the speculation on the price could be impacted like a stock. But what I will say is you're buying something with Jackal, or there's one called Kudos that I saw recently that is like cloud computing. We've seen tons of AI. The AI sector has been hot lately. But you're buying something in these companies where you have an actual revenue model, an actual business plan. They have an actual plan to grow adoption outside of the crypto industry. And for people that know me, Bibby's heard me say this 1,000 times before. Why did I start Fight Farm, and why is it pegged to MMA? Because if you peg anything to just crypto in a bear market, you're going to suffer. If you don't have something that is not related to crypto, whether it's sports or entertainment or some sort of business sector outside of crypto, so that you can have customers who, they don't care if there's a token, they don't care that there's a blockchain, they just want the good or service that you're selling. So for me, Escobin, that's what I want to see more of. It's not necessarily the actual infrastructure you're talking about, but a lot of these cloud computing, AI, decentralized storage networks, server farms, a lot of those are infrastructure, right? And they're infrastructure that we need here in crypto, but they're also infrastructure that the general public uses and needs. And if a blockchain or a token or a project in crypto can offer a service that competes with Amazon Cloud, that competes with Apple, that competes with Google, and they can do it faster, cheaper, in a more decentralized way, or in a way that lets like their users benefit in a Web3 kind of way, like, you know, as far as like earning from selling your own data and those kind of things. I think that's what we need to see more of. And that's one of the things that excites me, Escobin, is that we are going to see a different type of maturity and sector grow out of this bull market than maybe we didn't get in prior bear markets. Now, some people, because it's not going to be as hype, it's a narrative, but it's not as exciting as like, hey, this is going to 100x, or this is going to grow your bags, or this is going to blow up. Those things are still going to exist. But for me, I'm excited to see more of the mature projects that have actual business plans. Hopefully that helps give you an insight to what I'm thinking. So what about you guys?
Oh, I would ask you another thing before. What do you would say that's good tool that you have seen through this time that's a way to onboard people? Because when I try to explain, most of the time nobody has the time or doesn't care. How do you see a good way to onboard people?
You know, onboarding is difficult, and it's been one of those challenges that crypto has had since the beginning. I mean, for someone like me, I remember just trying to explain the concept of crypto is hard. I think now you have more people that it's been around for long enough that even if they're not like hardcore into Bitcoin or crypto, I think it's been normalized to where at least people are like, you know, I've sat on the sidelines for years. I should have bought Bitcoin when it was $30 or $100 or $1,000 and I didn't. Now it's sitting at 70. So I think like from a greed perspective, a safety perspective, when people used to look at Bitcoin or crypto as a risk on asset, I think with inflation and people seeing some of the cracks in the traditional financial system and the traditional money world, as far as like dollars and euros and the BRICS currency and the gold and the ETFs and paper money and the stock market, I think they're starting to trust crypto. Not totally, but I think their curiosity is there, is like, is there something to this? Is there maybe some safety into crypto that I haven't considered, because everyone tells me it's a scam, it's a Ponzi, it's dangerous. So I think from like the onboarding perspective of like trying to convince people to give it a chance, I honestly think that governments and corporations and all the stuff that we have a problem with as human beings, that we just don't like when people do bad stuff, it screws the masses over. I think that kind of adoption is doing it itself. The worse we see governments get, the more war, the more corruption, the more money printing, the more inflation that's actually affecting us every time we go to shop, every time I go to Starbucks, or every time I go to get food, or every time I go to the store, or go to get gas, you're seeing that crypto, especially as a hedge against inflation, or as a more better way to do business, because it's more easier to be more fair, at least be more to where you can monitor it and control it better. I think that kind of sells itself, which to me is exciting. Now, the onboarding from the perspective of the technical route, one of the tools, because I think that was one of your main questions, is like, what's something you can use to onboard people? And, you know, anytime you tell someone, hey, you got to go to Coinbase, or you got to go to this, or you got to use, you know, one of these apps like PayPal, or one of these investment apps where like there's a risk because it's a centralized exchange. They're actually using your money when you leave it on their exchange. There's risk there. It could be a honeypot. It could be hacked. But there are a lot of tools that are popping up that just lets you simply use your credit card. You don't have to fill out a million forms. They will make you KYC AML if you go over a certain dollar amount. But if you're just doing small transactions, like maybe $20 here, $100 there, a lot of times they won't even KYC or AML you until after you've hit a threshold of, say, $600 or something. So I think tools like that, one of them is called Kado. I think it's Kado, Kado.money. And it's actually a multi-chain app. I think it's one of the most useful tools to onboard someone new, because if you've ever set someone down and said, hey, man, you need to buy some Bitcoin or some ETH or some crypto, and they're like, sure, show me how to do it, and you set them down and you spend 2.5 days of getting them onto Coinbase. Well, why do I have to answer all these questions? I thought this was supposed to be different. I thought this was supposed to be a new system that was against banking and against all these KYC AML, you know. For one, it looks strange, it looks bad, it's time consuming, people get frustrated. Sometimes their bank or bank card doesn't work on Coinbase, sometimes their banks don't want them, sometimes they try to use a credit card and the credit card company doesn't want them to purchase crypto. Depending on what region of the world they live in, are they in Europe, are they in US, are they in South America, are they in Asia? You know, different regions have different, you know, views on crypto, so that could be an issue. So I think something like an app where you can just onboard someone, where you're like, hey, all they got to do is create their wallet, and then you fund that wallet with your credit card. Easy peasy. I think that that's probably one of the most useful apps to onboard someone. And for me, Kado.money is just one example. I'm sure if you look over on Ethereum or Solana or some of these others, there's probably other options. In Cosmos, there tends to be Kado.money, but Kado.money also lets you do stable coins. It'll let you do ETH. I think it lets you do Avalanche and some of these other EVM chains. So it's a multi-chain app, but the Cosmos applications, meaning if I say, hey, Escobin, I want you to try DAO. And you're like, well, I've never used a DAO. What do I need? Do I need a wallet? Do I need money? Like, yeah, if you had to jump through hoops at Coinbase or whatever your local centralized exchange is, and it took you 3 days to finally get your money, you may just give up. So I think having something like Kado.money, where the front end is built in to the app itself. So if you want to play Fight Farm, eventually I want to have something like Kado Money right on Fight Farm. That way, if a new non-crypto person stumbles across my app or my website, they can say, you know what? I don't know much about crypto. I don't know much about this wallet business. but this thing says all I got to do is create the wallet and fund it with my card. Let me try this real quick. If you can get those applications to work that quick and that fast and that easy, that's one big thing. And, you know, actually, I think Bibby and I were talking about this recently as well. So not only do you need to have the ability to create the wallet fast and store the money, we all know in crypto, the whole idea is for you to hold your own private keys or hold your own seed phrase, right? Why? If you hold that seed phrase, you can lose the wallet. You can lose the hardware wallet. If you protect those 12 words, no one can take your money. But try telling a brand new person, well, you got to create this thing. There's a 12-word seed. There's a 24-word seed. You got to protect it. You got to do this. You got to do that. You know, try to set someone up like that. It can be a very off-putting thing. They're like, yeah, I changed my mind. I ain't got time for this crap, right? So one thing they've done recently is they'll let you use either your social media or your Google, your Facebook, your Twitter, your Gmail, your Yahoo Mail, and let you set up your wallet only using your email. Kind of like when you use your email apps to log in or your social media apps to log into a website, and it doesn't make you like create a new email and password combination and fill everything out. You just use your email and it works, right? It's the same concept. So I think that's a useful tool for onboarding, is using something so that when someone's brand new, you don't have to say all the stuff about the seed phrase. Basically, what they do is they use your social media or your email. You sign up for the wallet. And yeah, eventually, if especially if they're using a lot of money, they need to get their own seed phrase. But that will come in time. If you're just trying to get some guy on to spend $20 or $5 to play Fight Farm or collect some NFT, do you think he cares about protecting a 12-word or 24-word seed phrase over $5 or $20? Not in the U.S., they don't. Maybe in a third world country where $20 might be considered a little bit more, but you could still narrow it down to them. Do you think they're going to care about protecting $3, right? Most likely not. Why? Because it's just not high on their radar. But anytime you tell someone, hey, I want you to put half of your life savings on here, that's where people start to say, let me make sure I understand how to control my keys and, you know, store this correctly. If it's written on a piece of paper, it could get wet, it could burn up in fire. Maybe I need to get these steel plates. Maybe I need to etch the words in steel plates. I need to have multiple copies in multiple regions. Like, there's a lot of things that we can get into about key management. But yeah, I think from an onboarding perspective, that might be something that you look at is, how do you create the wallet easily? How do you fund the wallet easily? And can you use some sort of social media or email application to manage the keys and make the setup easy while they're learning and getting into crypto, and then let them figure out the stuff they need to know later on? Hopefully that helps.
It's a lot. It feels like there is many variables that you have to learn, lots of different concepts that's
for sure
completely new about governance, about financial, about identity. In any place you look, it seems to be, you have to know a lot about different things. It seems really scary. It's really to manage and organize this profile that's like this Web3 profile that you gotta know how a blockchain behaves, so then you can compose your strategy easier. It seems a lot.
Yeah, I think you're right. And that's how you know, even though it's been 12 years that I've been in the industry, and Bitcoin started in 2009, so we're looking at like almost 15 years in. If anyone out there, if you think you're late, oh, believe us, you're not late. You're not even early. You're beyond early. Like 20 years on the blip of like the radar of humanity is nothing. And if you look at the early days of the internet, people think the internet started in the 90s. Yeah, for me and you and everyone else that was around, if you were that old, it did start in the 90s for us. But the layers of the internet actually started as far back as the 60s, the 50s. You know, all that technology that was built back then is what made the internet of the 90s and the early 2000s possible. So when people come on and they're like, oh, well, I'm late. Well, no, it's so hard that people can't even comprehend or keep up with the technology and all the things that they have to think about. Kind of like what you just said, you got to think about your security. You got to think about how does encryption work. You got to think about the financial aspect of it. You got to think about your identity. You got to think about key management. You got to think about how do different networks work, different consensus mechanisms like proof of work versus proof of stake. All these things can be very overwhelming for new people. So I think that Escobin, we are so freaking early that people don't even realize how early we are. We're not in the 90s internet era, dude. We're like in the 50s or 60s. Like, this is so early that it's going to take another two or three decades probably of kids growing up and just hearing the word blockchain and using blockchain apps as kids. Like, the people that used the internet in the late 80s, early 90s, we got to see the progression of like internet from as soon as it became like a public good all the way until now. And that's, let's see, we'll say 90, 2000, 10, 20. So that's 30 years. So that means that if you just took that, and we're not there yet. Bitcoin didn't start in 2009, and it means you're in 90s internet. Bitcoin started in 2009, and you're like in the 60s or 70s. So really, I think that you're at least 30 years out until it becomes so easy and so adaptable that everyone just uses it for everything. If you look at how we use the internet today, and it keeps getting easier and easier and easier, look at the progression of what your iPhone can do now. Remember in 2008 when the iPhone first came out, and yeah, you could get an app, you could do this or that, but you didn't even have YouTube working correctly as an app. I think you had to do it in the browser. Your Maps apps didn't work good at all. All these little bells and whistles that we have, every time you do an update now, there's something new that you have to learn. And crypto is the same way. You're talking about how it's so much, it's overwhelming. Well, we probably felt the same way about cell phones and internet when they first came out, but you still use them because they're useful, and you still use them because they're giving you some sort of value. I think crypto is the same way. I think those of us who see and understand that value now will keep using it. And I think as like everything else in technology, as we see ways to improve it and make it easier and better and faster and quicker, and you know, make it so people can just pick it up and go. That's like if you got your grandma on the internet in the early 90s and she was 80 years old, she wasn't going to mess with that crap. She had no clue what she was doing. Whereas now, to pull up a video chat app like you know, Skype or one of these video chat FaceTime and stuff on the phone, like any grandma who's 80 can answer a FaceTime call, and she doesn't have to understand the infrastructure below it. She doesn't have to understand the money behind it, the marketing behind it. She doesn't have to know anything. She just has to know how to push the button and it works. Crypto will eventually probably operate on a much easier, you're just going to push the button and it works. And people will understand the things that they need to understand to make it work. And the smartest people will probably still understand like what's going on under the hood. I don't think that because we are here this early and we're trying to understand everything that we learn about crypto, I don't know that that's meant for the world to know every single little thing about crypto. I think most people feel like things should run in a blockchain. And if you're the user, you just want the service. You just want the financial service. You don't necessarily care whether it's Bitcoin or ETH or Archway or this stable coin or that stable coin. You just want to be able to send money from A to B. So as long as the application works and it's easy, why do you care? Now, do you want to have the secure feeling that, hey, underneath the hood, I can trust the technology. I can trust the money because I may not understand how Bitcoin works or the blockchain or the halving cycle. I may not understand how like Ethereum works or smart contracts work or admin keys or, you know, seed phrases. You're like, I don't care. I just want to send money from A to B. So I think a lot of it's going to be a mixed signal where the smartest of the smart people, which I think kind of, you know, your average person is going to become a lot smarter about crypto because there's a lot of incentive and profit motive there for them to do so. But you're still going to have a segment of society who they don't know, they don't care. They're never going to become a crypto person. They're never. All they're going to do is just use crypto and use blockchains without knowing and without caring. And once you get to that point, I think we're playing a whole different ball game. But I'm guessing we're probably 30 years out from that, if I was guessing. And that's just my opinion. I could be wrong. It could come earlier. It could come later.
I think that what I'm afraid of is when you take all those levels of abstraction out of the front of the people, we end up with a disruption that's kind of hard to control, because we are having time about government, of traditional markets, like financial system, all of those things, like education, is still being doing like the same way of my grandfather was educated. And now we have way much better tools like AI. And these levels of disruption on these traditional institutions that you live, that we live in, when we see all of those things flipping, it's hard to deal with those trade-offs, but what's going on between. And then you, if you just cut it off, all those abstractions of the people, it's kind of complicated how they're going to behave about it. Some people don't know how to drive on those situations.
Yeah, I have some of those same concerns and fears, if I'm being honest with you. And you're not wrong there. And AI changes everything. So most of what I'm talking about, too, is without even considering AI. Because you're right. You take out levels of abstraction or people caring or controlling or understanding things, or everything's instant. And they also have, like, instant trust in what they're using. There's a lot of potential danger there. But yeah, some of those things are definitely concerning as well, and I do worry about it.
Thank you, sir. That's it. That's all I have to contribute.
Well, thank you, Eskimen. I definitely appreciate you. First time I followed you. But yeah, anytime you want to chat, feel free, man. I love to hear people's opinions and share mine as well. So, Bibby, did you start to say something earlier?
Yeah, I was going to say something. Well, you were just talking about the difference in assets and buying into something where there's some infrastructure in place. So like you're buying more than just something you can potentially make profit on. You're buying on something that has building part of the industry to make it stronger and helping facilitate processes. And that's the difference, right?
Right. But you still have to be careful, because all of that's going to be marketing, right? People say they're going to do that, or they are doing that. But if you have ones out there that you can verify that they're actually doing that, I think those are good investments for a long-term perspective, because some of these things like cloud storage and cloud computing are probably only going to become more useful and in use. And those markets are pretty razor thin on, you know, profits. And if blockchain or doing things in a decentralized manner could make it, you know, either open up more profit streams or revenue streams, or give the user something different than the way they normally do it, I think those could be the differences from a marketing perspective. But you know how the crypto space is, dude. For everyone that's actually doing something, there's 10 people talking about doing something. So you still got to be mindful and careful where you put your money at from an investment standpoint.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But, you know, me and you were talking earlier about AstroVault on Archway.
Yeah.
And one of the things I love about AstroVault is when you listen to Eric, and I know you've heard Eric talk, plenty of people in the space have heard Eric talk. When you hear Eric talk, he talks about things like this, where it's actual value, actual companies, actual revenue streams. They try to run their DEX where their DEX has multiple revenue streams. And they try to run their decks in a way where they're like, hey, a bull or bear market is going to impact us, but it's not going to matter as much as most decks, right? That's smart thinking. And one of the things I like about their decks in particular is it's newer, so it's not going to have as many assets in general as a decks like that's been around for a while has had. But I also have a feeling that they're just a little bit more picky, meaning every new shiny little meme coin, every new coin that launches, like they just don't look like they're rushing out to add every single thing. And they could say, well, let's get as many fees, as many trading volume, like every other DEX in the world. And you know what? That's good for a year and a half, 2 years in a bull market. But then what do you do once all the volume and liquidity leaves? If you don't have an actual viable way of making money besides fees, and you know, actual customers here in a bull cycle, you can't sustain yourself in a bear market. So that's one thing I like about Eric. And when they add an asset, you'll notice they're big on that asset. They're willing to hold that asset. They're staking that asset. They're using that asset to make themselves money. They're using that asset to make us money. And they treat the tokens and the projects that they list more like partners than just like customers. And I think there's something to that, because that means they're mindful and picky. That means, you know, hey, I'm not just going to list Jackal and hope that they're doing cloud storage right. Well, no, they probably understand everything Jackal's doing. They're probably using Jackal, or they're planning to use Jackal. I know they've helped get Jackal new customers by coming on Spaces and saying, hey, you guys really should look at using them. So they're more of a partner, because if you could just be a DEX that lists a token and then says, I'm going to make money on fees no matter what, and let me try to pump the volume. Instead of doing that, I think they're more looking at it like a partnership. Like, let's get them actual customers, actual users. And yeah, maybe short term, we don't make $1 zillion on fees on a pump and dump scheme like most DEXs do. But long term, we're going to build a stable of quality assets that actually have game plans, that actually have use cases, and actually have staying power that can thrive in a bull market or a bear market. And I think that's kind of like one of the things that attracts me to them, is that they tend to think more like I do, because that's exactly the kind of stuff I've been saying. And I try to do in my own projects, is I try to run it in a way to where, and I've told everyone this, everyone that's heard me talk before, my goal is to have an NFT project that's just as popular or more popular in a bear market than it is in a bull market. Name one or two top NFT projects you know of that actually do that. They don't. Even the biggest NFT projects with the biggest amounts of volume, most of them lose all their customers, all their trading volume, all their prices plummet. Even the biggest prices, even the biggest first movers on ETH, like the Punks and the Apes, and you look at everything on everything, even like Bad Kids over here in Cosmos. If all you do is have price speculation and some airdrops and some other stuff, you're not going to be like a token that keeps that value in the bear. You have to have something outside of crypto. You have to have something, whether it's a business, entertainment, sports, some sort of utility that's needed. You need something that will retain maybe not 100% of the users, because you're still prone to the boom bust cycles of crypto and people coming and going, but you need something that's still sustainable as much as possible in a bear market that can grow year over year, so that eventually you outgrow being definitely held to the bull bear cycle. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you want something that has some staying power. It's something that's gonna last. Hey, Chris, how you doing?
Hey, Chris. I don't think he raised his hand. He's still showing his listener. But yeah, you know, I think that when you listen to some of these guys who talk about these different DeFi projects, most of them are going to tell you, OmniFlix. People still ask me this day, like, why didn't you go to Stargaze? Why didn't you go here? Why didn't you go there? Why are you even in Cosmos? Why are you not on Solana, where all the NFT and all the DeFi volume is right now? Why are you this? Why are you that? Why did you not go to ETH? Why did you not do an ETH layer 2? Why is it when everyone left Cosmos and went to Polygon over the bear market, you stayed over here? Well, there's a reason, because I don't view them as an NFT project. I view them as a DPN, a decentralized physical infrastructure project. And I'm not saying that because of the narrative. Take the word and the narrative out of it. I chose OmniFlix because they're not just trying to be another NFT platform. They're trying to be a multimedia hub. They're trying to be a peer-to-peer hub, to where eventually, yes, you could have your stuff on the front end of the OmniFlix website, but eventually it's going to feel more like what we saw when the movie and the music industry started to kind of decentralize on its own naturally, where, you know, Chris can spin up his own NFT project, and yes, his NFTs may be listed on OmniFlix TV or OmniFlix the marketplace, but he also has his own marketplace with his own store and his own branding and his own content. It's like a standalone store that Chris spins up for his own branding. And why would you want to do that? Well, if I'm on Omniflix or any NFT website, as it grows, it either gets really muddy because there's too much there and there's a lot of bad that gets listed with all the good. We talked about that with all the garbage AI projects on Omniflix. It gets muddy, right? It's hard to wade through the mud to find the best. The only way to fix that is you have to have it curated, right? Well, that's good, except then you're trusting either technology like AI or you're trusting the users to rate things, kind of like what we saw with these rating systems. That's a good idea in theory, but if you're rating NFT projects like you're rating these tokens that were listed over on, what's the Corium Dex we just had launch?
Pulsera.
If you're rating projects the way these people rate projects over on Pulsera, and that's just an example, guess what? That happens everywhere, not just in crypto, but all over the web. You go to Google and you try to look up your favorite dentist and read the reviews. Out of every good review, there's two or three that are garbage. Either they're spam or they're negative reviews or people talking crap or people poking fun. They're trolls. You see what I'm saying? So do you really want your NFT to be subject or your token to be subject to being reviewed by the peers when really there's no incentive for like trolling and all this stuff not to exist? So that's not a good system. So then what are you back to? Well, that means Omniflix needs to control their front page. They need to control their what they market. That means someone there is curating, which means you could have either favoritism or censorship or blackballing. And I think all front ends need to take ownership and have run their front end however they want. However Omniflix wants to do it is cool. But the reason I chose Omniflix and the reason I think Omniflix is cool is because they're going to let you use their infrastructure and their blockchain and their marketplace stuff to run your own store, basically, your own node. And it's going to be a decentralized node where all of our stuff is stored everywhere. And there's probably going to be some sort of earnings. The same way you get paid to be a validator, you're probably going to have some kind of earnings where you can farm your storage space and store content in a redundant, decentralized manner for all of Omniflix. That's the long-term vision. And anyone who doesn't know this, they've got documentation before they ever launched or even launched their token, where they're talking about these kind of things. And one of these days we'll get Syslon for an interview and we won't even talk about the current state of Omniflix. We'll talk about the future of Omniflix, because that's truly what made me choose them. I could have went anywhere that immediately had more volume, more users, more eyeballs. The reason I chose them is because I didn't look at them as just an NFT platform. I looked at them as a physical infrastructure for future multimedia throughout crypto, throughout blockchain, throughout the cosmos. And dude, that's why I chose them. Hopefully that makes sense. And I would love to have Sisla on to clarify some of these statements and some of the documentation I've read and some of the things I've heard them say. And really, I might be butchering exactly what he meant by it, but I've heard and read a lot of these things. And one of these days I'll post the documentation so you guys can see exactly what I'm talking about. It kind of lays out the idea of like you run your own node. And see, another thing is the legal aspect of it, right? Right now, if you post anything on the front end, it's on the blockchain. There's nothing that Omniflix or any other blockchain can theoretically or technically do to remove content that's posted on chain. And if you could, that takes away the whole idea of a blockchain being immutable and censorship resistant. So you can't have one or the other. You got to have one or the other. So the only way you can do that is you say anyone can post anything on a blockchain. Even Bitcoin has child pornography on it. Why? Because it's immutable. Does that mean a front end should spin up and parse and filter and show you all of the child pornography that's on the Bitcoin blockchain? No. The Bitcoin blockchain is immutable, meaning you don't need permission. Anyone can post anything to the blockchain as long as you do it in the way that the mechanism that allows you to do it, whatever the rule set is to post a message on a blockchain. Well, Omniflix and NFT platforms are no different. Like, either you're immutable or you're not. And the thing I like about Omniflix is it's going to be immutable, meaning you can post whatever you want. So if you post something that's either bad taste or not socially acceptable or it's illegal, Omniflix doesn't have to parse or filter or allow that to be shown on their front end. But one of the cool things is the same way we see now, like when Congress is going after Facebook or Twitter and saying you should control the content that's on your platforms. And they're like, no, like I'm just the platform that allows users to control it. You should go after the users if the users are posting things that are illegal or threatening or hateful or this or that, right? Well, on the blockchain space, you should allow anything. We saw this on Hive and CMIT. You should allow anything to be posted. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't have a mechanism to block or censor content that could be illegal, depending on what jurisdiction you're in. And something like child pornography is going to be illegal 100% of the time everywhere in the world. Now, there are different things that may be legal in one district that's not legal in the other district. So that can vary. So when you think about it from that perspective, what Omniflix is going to build would theoretically allow them to have their cake and eat it too. They can say, hey, we're immutable. You can post anything. No one needs permission. Everyone has the ability to post content and you won't be censored. However, you have to host your own node to be able to do that. Meaning the Omniflix front end, they're at their own criteria of what they want to post. And people will say, oh, well, that's censorship, that's this or that. No, the blockchain allows you to post everything you want. Different front ends can have different levels of security or allowance. That's like when you go to places now, Twitter and YouTube and all these places, they may have different standards and say like a Rumble or this, you know, platform or this freedom platform or that freedom platform. Why? Because they get to pick and choose to what level they consider things to either be offensive or illegal or against the rules. And I think that's the beautiful thing about Omniflix is they're going to do it in a way that could probably legally protect themselves as the platform developers and the people that build the software that runs the platform. They can probably protect themselves by saying, listen, you know, we're not going to show this on the Omniflix marketplace, but nothing stops you, Chris, from paying the fee, spinning up your own media node, putting your front end together, and you can take all the garbage content. You can take all your porn AI you want and put up there. No one's going to stop you as long as you're not doing anything illegal. But if you do something illegal, Omniflix, we wash our hands of it. It's now, Chris, between you and your local jurisdiction. So that's the power of blockchain, and that's how you get a balance between freedom of speech and censorship resistance and being immutable and also protecting yourself legally or giving each person the ability to be responsible for doing either what's right or wrong, depending on where they live. And I may have killed the room with that one. So guys, thank you for coming to Crypto Canvas Chronicles. We had a late start today. We had a little bit of miscommunication. We're supposed to be talking about staking today, but we had questions early on before we had anybody else in the room. And I decided that, well, we started 15 minutes late and I didn't even know if people would come and stay. So we were talking about whatever, and we went down a rabbit hole of things. If anyone has questions or if you want me to gear back towards the staking, I can. Thoughts on that?
Always a pleasure listening to anything you have to say. So just take it wherever you want to go.
Well, you know what? I'm going to circle back, baby, because it's an important topic. And I'm going to try to keep it short because we've talked about a lot of other stuff. But what I'm going to say is what we were talking about earlier was when you hear the term staking, they don't always mean staking to the network. Meaning you're not talking about being a validator, staking your tokens to a validator, and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes people say staking and they're thinking about even something as crazy as like it's on a centralized exchange. Well, just because, you know, Coinbase says they're staking your tokens doesn't mean that your tokens are actually staked. Maybe they are, maybe they're not. They could be staking your tokens to the network for you and then scalping your payouts, which is what part of Coinbase's business model is. Like, why would you want to stake through a centralized exchange and pay X percent for them to do it, you know, when you could just do it yourself? Now, some people, if they're new, maybe that's valuable to them. They don't want to mess with it. They don't want to learn. Okay. Well, you're just giving a business model to Coinbase to extract some of your money, and that's fine. But you have to do zero work. But the problem is there's a trade-off there, right? There's a security, there's a counterparty risk there. They could be a honeypot for hackers. You could see a run where people go to withdraw a bunch of coins at once because the price is plummeting, and then you can't get them all out because Coinbase has them all staked. So that could cost you. So people just need to understand the risk of what staking is. Also, some places you don't need to trust them. Either they're bad people, they're bad developers, they're bad protocols. They could be good people. They just are bad decision makers and they don't know what they're doing. There's a risk anytime you give someone your money. And no matter what they tell you, you should understand what's actually happening in the background before you give them your money. Because if they tell you they're staking your coins, you want to know for sure, what do they mean by that? If a DEX says, hey, stake our DEX token, well, what do they mean? When you're on Pulsera and it says stake the Sera token, like, what's it actually doing? And what benefits do you have? Do you get governance? Do you get voting? Do you earn part of the revenue? Is that revenue from fees? Is that revenue the different tokens, the fees from the different tokens? Is it the Sera token? Is it inflation? What's the rate of inflation? How distributed is it? How much does the team own? How much is in the community chest? Like, how easy is it to spend that money? All these things you need to think about when you hear that term staking, because it's used far and wide, especially in DeFi. And a lot of times in DeFi, when they say staking, it has nothing to do with staking your tokens to a validator on the network, which is actually something you do in proof of stake for security. So I do want to just give a quick overview of what does staking for security do on a proof of stake blockchain. So there's this thing called consensus. Consensus means it's a general agreement among a group of people. And proof of stake versus proof of work, they're both consensus mechanisms that solve problems in blockchain of cryptocurrencies. Before any decisions are made, members have to come to an agreement on it before it's carried out. So proof of stake is a little bit different. Why? It uses randomly selected validators to confirm transactions and create new blocks. Whereas with proof of work, like with Bitcoin, it uses a competitive validation method to confirm transactions and add new blocks. So proof of work is using the actual work. The miners are solving problems. It's a race. It's still random to that extent, but you control a lot of the variables, such as the number of pieces of hardware you have, how you control the heating, the electricity, how good are you at upkeep, are you mining by yourself, solo mining versus mining in a pool? All these things come into play, but you're doing actual work, so to speak. Whereas on proof of stake, it's more random. Yes, you have to have your stake. You have to have a certain amount of money locked up. So does the validators. But there's more of a random, like, hey, there's different ways to provably choose how the validators are selected. And every blockchain, you know, is different depending on what type of proof of stake you're using. But the main difference between proof of work and proof of stake is that proof of stake relies on crypto staking, while proof of work relies on crypto mining. Both of these methods add new blocks of transactions to the historical record, and both provide a way for users to earn additional crypto. So, mining allows the miners to earn crypto as a block reward. Proof of stake also allows the validators to earn crypto as a block reward. The difference is proof of stake will allow users who are not validators or miners to delegate or lease a portion of their crypto to that validator to increase the stake, which increases their odds of being selected to produce a block, and also makes them more secure because the more stake they have locked up from a dollar value perspective, the more expensive it is to attack the network. You know, Bitcoin's expensive to attack because you have the cost of electricity, you have the cost of the hardware, a cost of all these things. You kind of have that with proof of stake. The cost of the hardware still exists, although cloud computing and that kind of thing can, you know, really make that a lot more affordable. But the cost in proof of stake is more like, hey, how much money is locked up to protect the ability for someone to make it cheap for them to come in and take over 51% of the network. So that's just something I want to touch on real quick, was what is proof of stake when you're validating and staking to a network? And what is the difference between proof of stake and proof of work? Any questions on that before we move forward? No? Okay, good. So while we're talking about proof of stake, let's just bring up three things. And we kind of touched on this earlier. You have a few different types of proof of stake when you're staking to the network. You have locked, kind of like what we see on Ethereum or on Cosmos, where once you stake it, it's locked up. And usually there's a unlock period. That could be a period of hours all the way up to a period of days or weeks before your tokens become liquid and you can spend them again. You also have liquid staking. And I don't mean liquid staking like what we see in Cosmos now, like liquid staking derivatives. I mean actual liquid staking as a protocol. This is going to be something like what you see on Tezos or Cardano. So on Cosmos, in order to stake, you have to take your tokens that are on your address. You have to go and select a validator, and you have to lock up your tokens on your address, but they're delegated to that validator, and there's an unlock period. Well, in liquid proof of stake, you have stuff like Tezos. If the tokens are sitting on the address, they're not being used for staking, but you can send them and spend them as you wish, right? So what they do is they allow you to keep those tokens liquid sitting on your address. And while they are sitting on your address, if you have a validator selected, they are still leased to that validator. The moment you send that crypto somewhere else, to another friend, to another wallet address, to an exchange, to a DeFi protocol, if you send it anywhere, it's no longer being staked, right? So it's only staked while it's sitting on your approved staking address with a validator selected. So that does make it more liquid. And that's one reason why people fell in love with Tezos and Cardano early, is because there was no unlock period. But a lot of people, especially in the NFT space, they would sell NFTs for Tezos for XTZ, and they leave it sitting on their address liquid, but they never selected a validator. They didn't even realize, hey, I can earn 7% interest just by my token sitting here if I take the time to set up and select a validator who can claim the least version of those tokens to add to their total amount. Now, there's also something called slashing that you need to be aware of. If the validator either makes a mistake unintentionally or intentionally, it can cost them money. And in many cases, it can cost you, the end user, money. That can be the same in both liquid proof of stake and locked up proof of stake. Last but not least, we also have delegated proof of stake. This would be more like what you saw on EOS, Hive, Steemit. There's many different delegated proof of stakes, especially like in the 2017, 2020 cycles. It was still kind of a big deal. But in those, you actually, when you stake your tokens, you're actually delegating them to a certain number of block producers, and you get to select your block producer. On the first two, you can still vote. On delegated proof of stake, you're actually giving up your right to vote. But one cool feature I did like about delegated proof of stake is not only could you delegate your tokens to a validator, you could delegate your tokens to any address. So if I had someone that I wanted to support, we're always used to saying, hey, like donating, right? Well, let me give you some crypto. Well, rather than give it to them, why not just delegate it to them? And if you have 1,000, you know, Hive tokens, and you're like, let me give 30% of those Hive. I'm going to give 300 over to Chris because I think he does a good job. And you would just delegate it to them. And as long as they were like using them wisely, they would earn that interest. But the tokens never left your address. They were sitting locked up on your address, but that person over there received the staking rewards. So you can do that with regular proof of stake as well, but delegated proof of stake actually did it in a pretty unique way. So that's the three kinds of staking I wanted to bring up. You have locked staking, you have liquid staking, you have delegated proof of stake. Any questions on that before we move forward? The one thing I will say is depending on which type of proof of stake that you're using, the custody, the liquidity, and the voting rights can all be affected differently. All right, quiet crowd. Guys, feel free. If you have questions, feel free to raise your hand. Come on up. I will pull you up. So now that we've just discussed the three types of staking, let's move on to the next portion. And basically all the above, whether you have liquid, locked, or delegated, they're all staking to a blockchain network, which is used to provide security and governance to that blockchain. Let's see. All right, so now we're going to talk about what we see more in Cosmos. And you actually see this on multiple types of different types of proof of stake blockchains, but many times people get confused because when you're talking about liquid proof of stake, like on Tezos, or like liquid stake, like on Cardano, where you're still delegating your tokens to the network for network security and governance, those are totally different than when you talk about like liquid staking derivatives. So in the Cosmos, when you lock up your tokens on your favorite blockchain and you earn that APR, you're delegating or leasing your tokens to that validator. So if they say they have a million of their own tokens locked up, but we have a group of us all delegating 200,000 tokens, it increases their max delegation to their node, which can increase or decrease or impact how they're selected to produce blocks and their rewards and all that kind of stuff, right? So the thing you got to consider, though, is in the Cosmos, when we lock up your stake, you lose the ability of that being liquid. You can't use it for anything else. And what we try to do is solve that problem. And the first thing I want to point out before I go any further is these things can be very good. They can be very useful. But like everything else in life and everything else in crypto, you have to consider the risk reward ratio, and you must consider the impact of, hey, there's counterparty risk here. What you have with a LSD, a liquid staking derivative token, is an IOU effectively, meaning it's not your actual value. So when you lock the value up, it's not your actual value that you're dealing with. So if there's ever a run on the money, depending on how the custody of your liquid staking derivative works, there could be a lot of issues getting your original tokens back. The other thing you have to consider is if there's ever an issue where things are being dumped or something depegs, you could see the price of the IOU, liquid staking derivative. Let's say if it's like for secret and secret's worth $1 and the S secret, which that's not a good example because that's the secret version. So let's go like, Osmo B Osmo, I guess, or Atom ST Atom, right? You could see, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the staked asset is your original asset, that price and the price between the IOU, which is the liquid staking derivative asset, could have a difference in price. Now, in some ways, once again, that could be good because volatility there, it could be an opportunity. You could arbitrage that and you could make money. But there's also some danger there, right? Your liquid staking derivative, for various reasons, could lose trust and lose peg to the value of the intended original asset. So be very, very mindful of that. The other thing to consider is this can become a little bit more centralized depending on which liquid staking derivative you're using and how they manage custody, how they manage which validators are chosen. There's many, many, many things to consider. And I don't want to like hype up one or bash one, but what I will say is if you're going to do LSDs, go do some research, watch some videos, talk to some people who are in the know, ask questions, and really try to understand what you're doing. And like anything else in crypto, be mindful of where you're at in the bull, bear, boom, bust cycle. Because many, many times, while these things can happen at any point in time, many times when things start to unravel and depeg, it tends to be towards the end of the bull market. When all the liquidity is leaving, when all the volume is dropping, when all the prices start to plummet down, if you're going to see things happen to staking derivatives, that tends to be a time that is more likely to happen. So that's just something to consider. So that's talking about the differences between proof of work and proof of stake. We talked about different types of proof of stake. We talked about liquid staking derivatives and how they're different from liquid staking like Tezos or Cardano. Any questions here on these things before we move on? All right. Doesn't look like we have any questions. So the next thing we're talking about is how staking does not always mean that you're staking to the network, to a validator. You can have things like where you're staking in DeFi. You could be staking to a liquidity pool. Usually people aren't going to use the term staking for that anymore, but I have heard people do it, especially in prior bull markets. Anytime you lock up a token, people may say the word staking. And that doesn't necessarily mean that they know what they're talking about, but people throw that term around. I will say it's getting better as there's more people and more people returning. I think those things will, like everything else, they kind of outgrow their flaws. But there's always going to be someone who says staking, and you want to make sure you understand what they mean. So I don't think you hear people say staking to an LP as much. I think you hear people say the words LPing or farming. But a lot of times when you earn a token from a DEX for providing liquidity, what do they tell you? Stake your token. Well, usually that token, it could be governance. It could be. There could be lockup periods, or there could be no lockup periods. But you got to understand what the token is, what the function is. Is there a reason to keep it? Is there a reason to stake it? What's the risk versus reward? Are you being used as exit liquidity, which is probably the most common thing to worry about? But that technically, are you staking because you're locking it up? Yes, but it's not the same thing as providing security to the network. It is more being used for governance, and it's removing the liquid tokens from the market. And whether that's an NFT, whether that is a token, a fungible token, it doesn't matter. Scarcity definitely impacts usability and could impact price. In some cases, it's also used against you, because if you lock something up and you can't get out of it, and everyone else is dumping all over you, then in that sense, yes, you created scarcity by staking your token and locking it up for 21 days for a high interest rate. But at the same time, everyone around you, they didn't have your best. They didn't have you in mind. They just want as much of it to be off the market so they can dump and scalp and take all the profit and get while they're getting is good. So you have to understand that when you hear staking in DeFi, that it could be a good thing, but you might want to be mindful of when you do it and how you do it. And even if you know that it's a bad thing, like there are certain things where I know they're just trying to screw people over. But if you've been around long enough and you understand how these things work, you can sometimes still use that to your ability to scrape a profit. I've definitely saw some things I was like, that is so shady. They shouldn't be doing that. And I would warn everyone against it. On the flip side of that, I was like, but they're screwing all these people over. You know, I know there's going to be people in there who definitely are going to lose their money. And then you have to decide, like, am I going to risk having my money in there? Some people always say that crypto or financial stuff in general is a Ponzi. I hate to have that mindset, because I don't think just because you can doesn't mean you should. But at the same time, I've been in protocols and I've been in things where I wasn't quite sure if I should be in them. And I was taking a risk, right? And in many cases, I got out early. That's kind of like when you're playing the top of a market. For every seller, there's a buyer. So, you know, if I'm selling my Bitcoin at $70,000 or $67,000 in 2021, did I screw that person over that bought it for $67,000? I don't know. We're in a gray area. Markets are markets. I know there's certain things in crypto that I definitely wouldn't want to keep my money in long term, because I have a feeling or an understanding that they're there to lock you in so that you can be used as exit liquidity. If even in LPs, if you're jumping from one thing to the other and you're there early, a lot of times you're getting in, you're scalping the liquidity, you're getting as much of the token as you can while the token price is either up or there's less volume, less people to dump it, and you're making as much profit as you can. And by the time the masses show up to that DEX to actually do LPs, you're already gone. You're on to the next one. So that's kind of what I'm talking about, is you want to be mindful of like how people in the crypto space think. Just because you can get a token and you can get a rewards token doesn't mean you should stake it. And yes, if you totally believe in it and you are looking at something long term, I understand why you would think, well, let me get in there and do governance and do this or that. But even if you do that at the beginning of a bear going into a bull, I think the closer you get to the second top in a bull market, you might want to consider unstaking most, if not all, of everything you have staked. Because generally speaking, there are certain things I'm going to keep staked no matter what. Like there are certain blockchains, like Archway, for example. I'm a huge fan of Archway right now. I will take profits. That does not make me any less of an Archway fan. I take profits on Bitcoin. That does not make me any less of a Bitcoiner. Some people will scream and yell about profit taking and you shouldn't do it and you're hurting the token price and this or that. Listen, those people are dumb. They don't understand how markets work. Just because you sell Apple stock doesn't mean you magically hate Apple. No, it means Apple's stock price went up and you're like, this probably isn't going to last forever. Let me sell this. And when the price drops, maybe I can get, you know, 1.5 or 1.8 Apple stock, you know, or two for the price of one. You see what I'm saying? Like markets are going to do what markets do. So when it comes to staking, and we're talking about this in the sense of DeFi, remember that some of these things are more like NFTs, NFT staking, like even for me, for my stuff, like for Fight Farm, you have to consider like, if I'm going to stake the NFT, like what's the upside or downside of what I'm doing? What's the risk versus the reward? What part of the cycle am I in? Do I have time to unlock and get out before I get dumped all over? Like what's my game plan here, right? So I guess that's what I'm trying to point out is that not all staking is safe. It's not all created equal. And whatever you do, you need to have some sort of game plan. You need to not just stake this stuff blindly and then you wake up and it's going to be we'll go January, February, 2026. You've already had a double or triple top in 2025, and all of a sudden it's January, February, 2026, and you're trying to unlock and unstake and get out of everything. You're trying to sell all your liquid staking derivatives. You're trying to get out of all your lending protocols. You're trying to get out of all your LPs. And meanwhile, something around you has happened and centralized exchanges have been hacked. People are having runs on their money. UST or Luna depegs and spirals out of control. Those are the kinds of things where staking and having your tokens locked in, whether you're on a centralized exchange or whether you're staking in your own wallet, whether you're using a smart contract, all these things, the timing makes a huge, huge difference. The risk I'm willing to take now in April of 2024, going into the halving, I have everything staked. Why? Because none of these prices are near the top. My Archway is not near the top. My Secret's not near the top. Token A is not near the top. Token B is not near the top. All these things that I'm doing in DeFi or staking or in DAOs, we're nowhere near to where I'm probably likely going to need to unstake and get out of it. At least based on my long-term plans, I'm willing to accept that low level of risk. Could I be wrong? Absolutely. Am I likely to be wrong? Based on past trends and cycles, probably not. However, the deeper you go into towards the end of this next bull cycle, and none of us know when that's going to be, we can only go by previous trends. And we also have to expect that the current trend could be different, especially with Bitcoin having a $70,000 top or $70,000 all-time high before the halving. This is unprecedented for us. So what I'm trying to say is like what I'm doing now is probably not going to be the same level of risk that I'm going to be willing to take in late 2025. Late 2025, fall, going in November, December timeframe, I'm probably going to be not staking any of my tokens to the network. I'm probably going to have sold some for profit. I'll probably be sitting on a multiple wide basket of stable coins, including Silk, including maybe something decentralized like IST, although there's risk there. Maybe something like USDC or any of these centralized ones, and there's risk there. But a lot of it's going to be back into Bitcoin, honestly. Why? Because all these things have risk. Even Bitcoin has risk, but guess what? To me, Bitcoin has the least amount of risk. So will the price of Bitcoin go down? Yes. Am I worried about the price of Bitcoin going back up the next cycle? Not really. If I'm in a dollar, you saw what happened. One of the scariest things we ever saw happened with UST last cycle. All these people thought, oh, I'm going to stake my UST the whole bear cycle and earn this 20% APR and just ball out of control in 2024 in the next bull market. And that got killed. That narrative died very, very quickly. And we can debate on what caused it, or whether it should have happened, or whether we were dumb, or whether it was intentional or attack. All that doesn't matter. What matters is where were you and what were you doing with your cryptos when that event happened? Guess what? A lot of people got caught with their pants down. And it wasn't just getting caught with your pants down and whether or not you were in Terra or IST. A lot of people got caught with their pants down because they were in FTX. They got caught with their pants down because they had their tokens deposited on these lending platforms who were not liquid. They had different tokens, quote unquote, staked. There's that word again, staking, on these centralized exchanges. And then they couldn't get their money out. They had DeFi protocols and stuff where their tokens were locked. And then as the token prices and the bear market started to set in, they couldn't get out quick enough to secure any level of profit, or lower profits, or in some cases, they may have even freaked out and sold at a loss, which at that point is probably a huge mistake, especially for, you know, some of these L1s that are likely to still exist in the next bull market. But anyways, that's kind of my take on it. I just wanted to touch on staking. So we covered a lot today. We covered many, many, many things before the staking, but I did want to circle back to that. Let's see. I'm going to check my notes real quick to see if there's one last thing I want to say. I think I covered everything. Centralized exchanges, DeFi. Oh, so the one last thing I'll say is anytime that you are looking at staking, whether it is staking to the network, staking in a DeFi protocol, staking in a governance protocol, staking tokens or NFTs, you should always be looking to evaluate the risk. You need to see how is custody handled, how is governance handled, is there an unlocking period, what's the risk of the token itself, of the NFT itself, what's the floor price, can the...
Hey, Chris, I think we lost you. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of trash is under the dirt. We rape them under the earth, sit and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Motherfuckers walking around here looking faceless, trying to make a living selling friendship bracelets. Dead ends dragging out the max amount of payments. Red down days got them acting all bankless. Yo fam, what? Check these tokenomics. They probing this bear, flexing broken honest. I had to lay my soul down, I'm just roasting otters. And then to end a long day, 11 bowls of chronic. Never known the politic, I was born to frolic. It's been my policy to pollinate all over the plot. We got a lot of apologists jumping in at the top. We like to measure their velocity before they hit rock bottom. Over impossible loss, it's all moss, and I'm liking the odds. Fondue in the morning, forming mycological bonds. Flick the cap, though the road is highly involved. Flip a coin, diary falls. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the burbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, sit and wonder about the worth. And play ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Trying to figure out the max amount of DNA stacked in non-toxic just to get a better place. Smacking on the hostage like this shit is play for keeps. Clowns, white knight, and all these Maybellines. They call it implausible when model after model keeps on ripping off the coat and going full throttle. Beats tearing apart your community. All these low hanging fruits bearing zero liquidity. Got a planet in reach, coming standard to each. I'm on the back 10 stargazing after the siege, commanding all the management to grab a few seats. And then we'll round up the beasts and send a messenger east. Y'all better sign a release when I'm bumping these beats. Hands up if I got motherfuckers drumming the streets. Yo, we got a few dubs, we got a couple defeats. And if you're coming for the king, you better have some of each. Motherfuckers screaming out loud, looking for mercy before they find themselves working a corner down in Jersey. What could be worse? Misrepresenting the first come, first serve mentality stuck in the verbs. I'll be numbing up first before discovering what works, and we'll see what other kinds of treasures under the dirt. We rape and plunder the earth, say and wonder about the worth and play. Ring around the rosy while the thunder is served. Bye.